This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Julian Ng and Roshan Kanison this morning. It's 6 o'clock, Monday the 30th of September, and we're into another work week, guys. But first, how was your weekend? What did you do?
Great. Good morning, guys. I actually was working over the weekend. I know it's not good work-life balance.
Definitely not, Julian. What happened to taking a break, you know, maybe going on a little short holiday?
I know, which I'm a strong advocate of.
And I was at APW watching other people work out. There was this competition, fitness competition thing going on. And just watched everyone do very hard things. It was entertaining, but also...
At APW?
Yeah. So there's this gym called Playground or something like that. Maybe right. It's ironic. You think you want to go to a playground to have fun, but really you just go there and suffer.
Maybe to some people this is what they consider fun.
Sure.
The world is a strange place.
Indeed it is. But in order to kick off this work week for you, we have lots of fascinating things lined up. What do we have on the docket first?
Yeah, something strange is also happening in the IPO market in the US. Companies are cancelling the IPOs one by one. So we are asking the question if the IPO market is getting spookier in the United States.
And right on the back of that, actually, we're going to also talk about the fall of Adam Neumann. And if you don't know who that is, he is the CEO and founder, or was the CEO of WeWork, and basically his fall from grace recently.
All right. Now, if you want to weigh in on those conversations, remember you can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We're also going to be talking about the best thing to start your morning with, aka a cup of coffee. After this, here's Heroes by David Bowie, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Better Things by Sharon Jones, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Julian and Roshan. So the best thing to do when you get up in the mornings, I find, is generally to start the day with a cup of coffee. And the BBC has an article explaining just exactly how the world came to run on coffee, because we're really rather reliant on it, aren't we?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think that we are not made to work. You know, it's unnatural. First of all, so we need help, right? And coffee, among other things, is one of those helps that we can get. I mean, other countries, you get very easy access to, the kind of drugs that would make you focus. But here, you know, good old coffee does the job.
Yeah, the real black gold is coffee. You know, we always talk about oil, but coffee is essential to my life. But nowadays, actually, I try to wait a few hours before consuming coffee, except for today.
How do you function then in the morning?
I just let my body wake up on its own. And it's recently only worked. Mm. And I find that the coffee hits me better after a few hours, already a good baseline.
Yeah.
Then the caffeine really kicks in, as opposed to using it to simply wake me up.
You're a very extreme person. Waiting for a few hours before having that cuppa.
But it does kind of reset your brain a little bit, right? Because when you drink a lot of coffee, you do get immune to the effect of the caffeine.
Yes.
So if you give yourself a break, maybe cut down on your coffee consumption over a period of maybe a week, it will be more effective at the end of that week. So it's a bit of a detox, I think,
yeah,
in that respect.
The most difficult part for me, actually, was getting used to not drinking a hot drink first thing in the morning. Because that's really the habit that you've built, right? We've all grown up drinking something hot in the morning, first thing.
Mm.
And that was so... I was drinking hot water,
Have Milo, God forbid.
I don't want to drink Milo first thing in the morning either, Jules. I want to stay away from the caffeine and the sugar at
right.
one shot.
Tea, perhaps?
Yeah,
good old
probably.
Tea,
yeah. Mm. Yeah, but it just goes to show you how important coffee has become, right? You've got cafes in the last few years, third coffee culture has become such a big thing. And before that, Starbucks really defined what coffee was for generations, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that one of the big issues today is the fact that when you get a high, for even a coffee high, or there are other forms of addictions as well. But the next thing you want is a higher high. And that's the problem, right? And this is afflicting the world today. We have an opioid addiction. We have all sorts of addiction, including sugar. And I think you're right to take a step back instead of just heading towards that cup of coffee the moment you wake up. I think it's a good thing that you're doing, because you are just readjusting your body back to its natural state and not trying to search for that higher high. And that's very dangerous in today's world. I mean, it happens with social media as well. We are addicted to social media. We're chasing the next thing.
Dopamine hit, essentially.
Yeah.
But at least with the coffee addiction, this is something that companies themselves are also starting to enable almost, because we've seen the rise of, niche cafes not just startups, but in big corporations, because good coffee is starting to be seen as almost a workplace perk. So, you know, it's just at the end of the day, increasing employees' access to caffeine, which probably is not great for the employee, but hey, maybe better for their bottom line because they work longer.
I mean, there's only so much coffee you can drink before you crash, right? Or before you start to lose your mind a little bit. But, you know, Jules, going back to that, you're talking about addiction, right? It feels like that when you first cut yourself off from caffeine or even sugar. I did this for a while. You really do start to feel withdrawal symptoms.
Yeah,
you start getting headaches, and you start getting cranky, and you're perpetually hungry. But then once you break free, it's so liberating.
Very few people do, Roshan. Very few people do.
And that's why I definitely don't have the discipline to break free from that sugar addiction.
Exactly. You know, and that's why all these co-working spaces, I mean, you're talking about corporations aiding and abetting this addiction, right? And co-working spaces are actually exactly doing that, providing you with free coffee that's being made by a professional barista, even bottles of beer, as we would do in the United States, and unlimited access to sugar, right? This candy, the sweets, the soda that's in the office. So corporations realize this, and they want to give you that access to the addiction.
It's enabling, right?
It's totally enabling, right?
Whatever.
Because how else can you do your work without some kind of a drug?
But then I guess there is the other perspective, which is that coffee isn't essential to your daily life. I mean, if you look at Switzerland had essential stockpiles since, I think, between the First and Second World Wars. And one of those essentials was coffee. And it's only now, this year, that they've actually put forward a proposal to maybe end stockpiling of coffee, because now they're thinking, maybe not so much of a necessity after all. But in Switzerland, people consume 9 kilos of coffee per person on an annual basis.
All right, I was worried you're going to say monthly or daily, because that's a lot of coffee.
Okay, I mean, 9 kilos is pretty much, quite a lot on a yearly basis too.
In my house, we buy 1 kilo a month, but that's split between me and my wife. So that's 6 kilos for us in a year, excluding the coffee that we drink outside of the house.
So 9 kilos a month.
Sorry?
9 kilos a month.
No. 1 kilo a month.
Oh, yeah.
So 12 kilos a year. We're just slightly below the Switzerland average.
All right. I'm pretty sure I would be hitting the Swiss average, because at one point I was drinking 5 cups of coffee a day. Not something I would encourage people to do in general, because the high, I guess.
Jitters.
The jitters are a real thing. But do let us know your coffee habits. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Here's a few messages coming up for you, and then we'll be taking a look at the haunted IPO market. So be sure to stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Julian. Now, that was It's a Sign by Teenage Fan Club. And I think nowadays, all these major companies looking to go into the IPO market look at Uber, Lyft and maybe a little bit of WeWork and say that's a sign that maybe we shouldn't be going to market this year. Because there have been a couple of articles this morning specifically to do with the IPO market and how it is actually becoming a lot more hesitant, I think, with the multiple flops that we've seen this year.
Yeah, I think I don't view this as a flop. I think it's really value coming up to the fore, and investors are showing that they can assess an IPO for what they are, right? Because they are rejecting WeWork's valuation of almost $50 billion, and now WeWork is finding itself having to undervalue that substantially by more than half, and even shelving their IPO. I think that's a good thing. It's very good for price discovery. It's very good for how the market is working.
Yeah, WeWork itself is actually quite incredible. Before we get to the rest, because they went from $47 billion to half of that, $24.5 billion, to what we can assume is nothing at this point, because they've postponed their IPO indefinitely. But they're going to have to IPO at some point, because these these private venture capitalists are going to want their money back. And you know, I read a lot from this guy, Scott Galloway, who's a professor at NYU Stern, right? And he studies these companies in particular. And he calls the valuation of WeWork at more about $5
billion. $5 billion. That's a tenth of what they were initially valuing themselves at.
He's valuing it as a real estate company.
That's I think it's the same guy who says that Uber is like way, way undervalued.
Yeah.
Overvalued.
Overvalued. Sorry. Yeah. Because he says he called Uber drunk and disruptive and just called WeWork drunk itself. Mm-hmm. Because so the point is that Uber has a value proposition to give and it is a tech company. It's just it's not being run well. Where else WeWork is just an overvalued, inflated company that used, what was it, proprietary technology 127 times in their prospectus or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's the illusion of tech company.
Yeah, so if we look at the IPO market overall this year, there have been a couple of bright spots. Like Beyond Meat was the mm-hmm. best performing IPO this year. I think they're trading at 500 times their initial IPO price. And there were a couple more that opened, you know, 11% above their IPO price. It was not too bad. But overall, we have seen some of the companies that have gone to IPO lose about a third. Like they're trading like 28% below their initial price. So it just goes to show that the market, I think, is no longer really as accepting of these vague promises of profitability with no actual timeline attached. Because Uber and Lyft also don't know when they're going to be profitable. WeWork was one of the ones that said, oh, we're not going to be profitable for the foreseeable future. And yet they expected people to buy mm-hmm. into them.
I am of the believer that there is too much time spent thinking about IPOs because IPOs are only a small window of a certain corporate's history, right? It's that point in time where they raise money and they get validation about the kind of valuations they have in their heads. And really, the entire journey of a company is extremely long-term. I mean, you look at Amazon, that's a 20-year-old internet company, which is supposed to be a new economy. Now the new economy is 20 years old, right? Amazon mm-hmm. has had that journey. And so have other companies where the IPO is a distant memory for them, right? So too much attention is being paid on the IPO. And it's a rigged market anyway, because as you said earlier, Roshan, IPOs are there. One of the main reasons is for exit of certain investors, right? So it's, yeah. it's rigged. It's negotiated by the investment banker. On one side, there are people who want to get out. On the other side, there are people who want in. And this thing is rigged to an extent where, oh, if we see a company appreciating 10 times, 20 times, oh, that's a successful IPO. And a company that has fallen 50% in price, that's an unsuccessful IPO. I think that's very bad, because if your company appreciates substantially, it means that the company has been robbed of precious capital to fund their future growth.
Right? Money was left on the table, essentially.
Exactly. Like too much money was left on the table, right? If mm-hmm. So a correctly priced IPO shouldn't move on the first day of trading, and that means that the company has gotten the right amount of funds for their long-term development.
Yeah, and you know, some of the companies that we've seen do well this year in the IPO market are not the big names. They're all very understated. Zoom Video Communications. No one knows this because it's a B2B product. And they've done well above their IPO today. Beyond Meat, that's a B2C product, fine. But these big names, especially the big three like Uber, Lyft, and Slack, who have IPO'd this year and all connected to SoftBank in one way or another, they've all done really badly. Now, I feel bad for Slack, though, because their attrition
Slack opted for a direct listing.
Yes, but their market attrition can really be related to the fact that Microsoft is taking a look at them and has essentially has created a product called Microsoft Teams, which replaces Slack for companies.
I think Slack listed correctly because if you look at the pricing of Slack, right, it's come down, mm-hmm. which means that the sellers or the buyers won over market participants, right?
Yeah.
So enough money went into the company. And, you know, the valuation hasn't gone to zero. So the company is still around. I like that direct listing idea because it takes the role of investment bankers out of that IPO decision. And it becomes less of a rigged situation for me.
Indeed. And after this, we're going to be continuing the conversation with a closer look specifically at WeWork. So be sure to stay tuned. But first, here's There's No Other Way by Blur. And after that, the 6:30 news, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Mark, Julian Ng and Roshan Kanisen. Earlier, we were talking about the IPO market and how it's getting a little bit more nervous since we've seen the underperformance of some of several big IPOs, Uber, Lyft and Slack come to mind. But WeWork has also been on the forefront of any IPO discussion over the past month because they tried to come to market and eventually wound up halving their valuations and shrinking it even further, and now they are postponed indefinitely. And WeWork is quite interesting because WeWork is almost a personality cult in a sense, right? Because centered around the former CEO now, Adam Neumann.
That's right. There were a lot of shenanigans that was happening with Neumann, and was reflected in the prospectus as well. But this is really a house of cards, WeWork's problems, because everything on it depended on the capital that they were going to raise through an IPO. And in the absence of that, people are already talking about using the bankruptcy word, right? The B word on WeWork. And, you know, landlords around town sort of cancelling their deals with WeWork for fear that they couldn't fund, you know, the kind of renovations and spending, pre-rental spending on their assets. So, yeah, this is really down to Adam Neumann.
Yeah, a lot of this, you know, we've seen this before, right? The cult of the CEO. And with WeWork specifically, it was the personality was bigger than the business itself. Now, we've seen cult CEOs before. Steve Jobs comes to mind. And I mean, the thing is, Steve Jobs was kicked out of his company once upon a time. And he came back and with his personality on top of a business that was had a product to deliver, grew, right? He brought the ideas and a tangible, well-valued idea, right? And you could bring to market and you could sell. Adam Neumann had lavish dreams and big ideas that really had no basis in recurring revenue or were overvalued. And I think now he has to sell a private jet and three private businesses of his own in order to kind of build up some capital because they've got no money. The reason they needed to go to market was because they needed to raise cash. And even those loans that they had agreed to with certain banks were contingent on the IPO going forward. So now everything seems to be in Masayoshi Son's hands at this point, SoftBank's hands.
Yeah, it's not just Steve Jobs, right? We have seen these CEO cults popping up, particularly in the tech sector, but I think there are a few also in the financial sector. I mean, in the tech sector, you have Elon Musk, you have Jack Ma, and these are people whose names really drive the success of their businesses. And it can actually be flipped around and taken advantage of. Because if you think about Elizabeth Holmes, right, of Theranos,
right.
She really tapped into the idea of the CEO as put forward by Steve Jobs, but she actually didn't have a product to sell. It was all smoke and mirrors. And in a sense, I think this is what Adam Neumann also did. Because it was his ability to sell smoke and mirrors and to make WeWork to kind of change your reality, to make WeWork sound like a tech company when it isn't.
Well, I don't think that the cult of the CEO is necessarily a wrong thing because we really have to separate the wheat from the chaff because the role of founders in their companies is to provide vision, right? And SoftBank themselves are launching the second vision fund. They even call it the Vision One, and Masayoshi's son actually thinks in terms of the extremely long term. I mean, he's got a 300-year plan for SoftBank, right, and for the world. So these are visionaries that we actually need. Whether good or bad comes out of how their alpha personalities would lead them to run their company, that's a separate issue altogether. But this is precisely how the capitalistic market works, right? Mm-hmm. Some people accept them, some people don't. It's fine. But this is very different from CEOs and cult personalities who have got nothing to sell, right? They're not visionaries. They're just trying to dupe the market. And that's what Theranos and perhaps, I don't know, I think WeWork's business model is not a bad one. It's not a bad one.
It's just not what it was sold as.
Exactly, yeah.
So I spoke to Common Ground and The Grill, right, recently, and they're doing well. They're profitable per outlet, per space that they have. It's a good value proposition, but they don't kid themselves. They're not a tech company. They are a alternative to renting spaces, essentially. WeWork's valuation came from the personality, came from the hype, came from the fact they were a quote unquote tech company. So like I mentioned earlier, Scott Galloway, this professor from NYU Stern, he ballparks WeWork's valuation around $5.5 billion, which for a rental services company is good. For a tech company, maybe not so good. So are you saying that Adam Newman's valuation of his personality is around $40 billion? That's kind of where the hype is.
Mm-hmm. I think the business model of WeWork itself is no different from some of the other tech companies. Mm-hmm. In fact, all tech companies, which are very ambitious with what they want to do, basically they're trying to sell a dream, right? And it's just premised on the belief of unlimited demand, right? Because you're renting long term and you're selling short term, and that's the problem. Mm-hmm. When you do that, you need a lot of debt, right? And it's kind of like an agent, a short term arbitrager to really help the very subdued property market. I mean, there is so much empty space in cities like New York and around the world because the old brick and mortar companies are closing down. So mm-hmm. here comes this guy who's trying to mop that up, mop all the empty space up and sell it in little bits and chunks to people who want to rent short term, but his liabilities are long term, and that's the problem.
And if you want to listen to more conversations about co-working spaces, you can check out That Breakfast Grill with Erman Akinci, co-founder of Common Ground, on the BFM app as well as on Spotify. Right now, though, we are heading into a few messages, and after that, we'll be taking a look at what's been said in the papers. So be sure to stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Chain Lightning by Steely Dan, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Julian and Roshan. Now, thank you very much for any messages you've sent this morning about this. We are going to take a look at what's been said in the papers first up. So why don't we take a look at what's been said on the Malaysian Reserve?
All right, right on the front page, Malaysia is going to return plastic waste, about 240 containers left to go. There's a lot of plastic there, looking at the containers, and I just don't know where these things come from. Other people's rubbish, we're returning that. Also on the sidebar, universities urge to realign courses with IR 4.0. That's what the Higher Education Department is announcing, that 19 public universities are cancelling up to 38 programs. The government requires them to come up with courses that are aligned with the fourth industrial revolution.
That's quite interesting, actually, because we've had lots of conversations about the fact that university tertiary educations are becoming increasingly privatized and increasingly also out of step with what the labour market actually wants. So I guess this is now the attempt to maybe bring them slightly more into line. But whether or not the government coming in and saying, you know, stop these courses, you have to come up with new ones, whether that's going to really solve the problem, because at the end of the day, universities, especially if you've got lots of private universities in the market, they're going to be geared towards getting as many students as possible.
Yeah, you need the required academic staff for that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, you know, I don't know how much regulation or government policy will be able to play a role here, because every time we seem to want to fill a gap in one part of, like, in terms of career aspirations, let's say right now,
we create a gap somewhere else.
Somewhere else. And right now, there are a lot of people, there is a gap in the workforce for tech companies. And maybe we've got too many engineers because ONG is down. Can policy really change that? Is it nimble enough to quickly...
What's ONG?
Oil and gas.
Oh, oil and gas. Okay. Yeah.
So is policy quick enough to change that? Because these are things that happen over years.
I think we are always one step behind, and we're kind of creating a boom and bust scenarios as far as churning out graduates are concerned. You know, when the trend is really hot, we say go into that sector, mm-hmm. and after that, the trend ends, and we got a surplus of graduates who don't have a job.
Yeah, because it's always at least 4 years. You're trying to look like 4 or 5 years ahead, right? Because you decide on a university course, then you have to complete that university course, and what the actual market is going to look like by the time you graduate is very different. It could be very different.
It's demand and supply, right? Look at the property market. It's the same thing. There was demand for a particular property. You take 3 years to build that property to meet the so-called demand. By the time all these properties come online, there is now way too much supply of that particular thing. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. Yeah. It's a same thing happened with doctors, right?
Yep.
It takes 8 years, 7 years, some amount of time to become a doctor. So for you to meet that demand and supply, it's a 7-year lag time. And by the time you come out, you may not have a job waiting for you.
Like a single malt whiskey is the other prime example, right? 20 years, two decades to brew that. But anyhow, it's not wrong that the government is thinking about it, because you do have to think about it, and you got to have some kind of policy about education and employment.
And speaking about things the government has to think about, budget's coming around the corner. And on the front page of The Edge Weekly, the title is Pump Priming in Uncertain Times. I think this is a question we've asked ourselves on The Morning Run quite often in the recent weeks, watching how other central bankers have cut rates, how they're offsetting monetary policy, adjusting fiscal policy. So the question is, will Budget 2020 see an expansionary policy, and how do we, and whether that will really help stem the coming tide of a global economic slowdown, and how that will work out. In fact, if you go to the back pages, Carmelo Ferlito of Ideas has a has an editorial about what policy means and how whether when the government is looking to diagnose a problem, are we looking at the symptom or just the cause? Because a simple policy is not going to fix everything when it comes to the economy.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, because when you pump prime, does it mean that you are departing from your discipline of keeping to the budget deficit, right? Because that will call for perhaps abandoning or even modifying that deficit policy. And around the world as well right now, people are already talking about, downplaying monetary policy and pushing it to a kind of fiscal policy.
But speaking of Budget 2020, the Star has gone with a headline, The Vote Swing Factors, because the Tanjung Piai by-election is going to be held after Budget 2020 is actually announced. And so apparently some political analysts believe that we could see some goodies being dished out during the by-election in order to win those votes. But at the end of the day, it is likely that it's going to boil down to the candidate who's been fielded, to see whether they can really win the constituency, because it is quite a mixed constituency. 57% Malay, 42% Chinese, 1% Indian. And the seat did fall vacant after its incumbent, Datuk Dr. Mohamed Farid, who was deputy minister in the Prime Minister's department, died on the September 21st of a heart attack.
You know, it's funny how these incentives come along when a by-election comes along. I'm not saying anything else aside that, but, you know, it's a coincidence maybe. I don't know.
Complete and utter coincidence indeed. But right now we are going to be heading into the 7 o'clock news, and after that we'll be tackling the business end of The Morning Run. So here to take you into the news is The Counting Crows with Accidentally in Love, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.